you for listening to this sermon from Arapahoe Road Baptist Church. We hope you enjoy the teaching of Dr. David Rogers, lead pastor of Arapahoe Road. For more information about our church and its ministries, please visit arapahoeroad.org. And now, here's Pastor David Rogers.
Amen. Amen. Thanks for being here. You can be seated. Thanks for letting me pray over you. Man, what a joy to be able to do that today. If you have your Bible, I invite you to take it and open it to Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9 is going to be on page 814 if you're using the Bible in the row in front of you. If you don't have a Bible to call your own, come see me when we finish this morning. I'll make sure that you have one to take with you. When I begin my sermon preparation each week, if I'm preaching out of a New Testament passage, which Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, is in the New Testament, as I'm praying and after I read the scripture that we're going to be attacking in sermon prep, I always read from my favorite New Testament theologian. His name is N.T. Wright. I quote him often. I've got a connection with him. These are a couple of pictures. I've shown these to you before, so maybe they look familiar. The one on the left in the black and white, that is Dr. Wright that was hosting me and a group of youth pastors that was over in his home country over in England. He was the Bishop of Durham at this time, and he got to live in what's called Castle Auckland. And so we had breakfast at his house, and he is holding my doctoral project with me, of which he was a part of. And so that is like a huge highlight in my life. The picture on the right is he came through town and was speaking down at SMU when he had just done his latest book, The Day the Revolution Began, and got to connect with him for a few minutes. And so it was just a great moment. And I love this man so much. And one of the things that I love about Dr. Wright is that he's British, and when I read his works, he makes references to things from Britain that remind me of my time in England. And so in my office, if you come see me, you'll see on the wall this right here. This is a letter from the very first time that I ever had the opportunity to preach in England back in December of 2000 at Billingham Baptist Church. And so they wrote me a little thank you, Pastor David, for coming and spending the time with us. And they gave me a little 40-pound love offering, which is great. And I just thought, man, what a generous and sweet church. And so I just framed that just to remind me of that time in England, the very first time that I ever went there. Is that blinding anybody, by the way? Because we've got like the sun is right there and it hits and it will like totally fry your retinas if you're not. I just want to say I'm just being cautious. Is this glaring anybody? Okay, good. I'm just going to leave that right there then. So I fell in love with the people and the country of England during that vision trip that started a long-term partnership. And if you check my passports over my life, you would see that there were about 20 stamps from going over to England over the past 19, 20 years. And I just love that place. I love those people. And one of the things that I remember is what Dr. Wright wrote about in a commentary that I was reading that's connected with this passage that we're going to walk through today in Matthew chapter 9, verses 18 to 26. And back in the early 2000s, just a couple of times after I had been there, we went one time and there was this outbreak across the United Kingdom of an animal disease called foot and mouth disease, and it affected thousands and thousands of farm animals that had to be slaughtered because this disease was so contagious, and it was just running rampant all over the United Kingdom and a lot of the English countryside that's just beautiful and you love to ride out in or walk out in, or you'd see people out walking their dogs or playing sports. You couldn't do any of that. They shut all that down as they tried to contain and then eradicate this foot and mouth disease. And I remember that we were driving from different towns to different towns, these little villages up in the northeast of England, in vans or in cars or whatever. And we would go across bridges in and out of the towns. And there would be these chemical stations on the bridge that you'd have to drive very slowly over so that your tires would roll through this disinfectant reluctant solution. So it was trying to make sure that if you were out in an infected part of the country and drove through some soil or whatnot that got onto your tires, you wouldn't track it in and out all throughout the country. I mean, when we came in and out of the airports, we had to walk through this disinfectant solution to try to keep the disease from accidentally coming into another country or coming into our country. If we had been walking out and gotten some soil on the bottom of our shoe or something like that, I mean, they were going to extreme measures because this was a major, big deal. And so Dr. Wright notes in his commentaries about how all societies have hygiene regulations, and it's only when something gets instituted suddenly that you realize it. It's like, wow, something's going on here. I mean, they're going to extreme measures here to make sure we're not spreading something that doesn't need to be spread, as was the case over in England a few years ago with the farms and the foot and mouth disease. But the societies before modern medicine, when you couldn't cure infections nearly as easily as we can now, it was vital to have strict codes about what you could and couldn't touch, what you were to do if you came into If you touch something that you weren't supposed to touch, then what were you supposed to do to then become clean or try to help make sure that you're not accidentally spreading something to other people? I mean, it's not like everybody in ancient history was trying to be legalistic about stuff, although some were. It's that most of the time they were just trying to be kept alive. They were just trying to make sure that they weren't spreading germs and infections and contagious diseases that could wipe out a whole town fast, if not contained. And so these purity laws were really practical wisdom to help keep a society in good shape and in good health. And in biblical days, the Jewish people, they had all kinds of regulations and laws to help try to keep the general population clean and healthy. And two of the laws that were at the top of the don't touch list were don't touch a dead body, and you're like, no problem there, and don't come into contact with a woman who is bleeding internally, be that her monthly cycle or something more chronic that she's been dealing with. Because if you do happen to touch a dead body or come into contact with a woman who is bleeding internally, then that becomes incredibly inconvenient for you, because now you got to do all this washing, which you do anyway, right? Say yes. Yeah, you do that anyway. But then not only do you have to wash your body, you got to wash everything that you were wearing, and then you've got to isolate yourself, quarantine yourself for a certain amount of time to try to make sure anything that's unclean about you doesn't spread. I mean, it's really inconvenient to become unclean because of who or what you touch, or who or what touches you. So if you want to stay clean, you need to steer clear of these untouchables. And in our text today, in Matthew chapter 9, verses 18 to 26, we're going to see that Jesus encounters both of these situations, a dead body and a woman who has a chronic bleeding issue inside her body. And what could be viewed as incredibly inconvenient encounters to Jesus and to everyone around him, Jesus sees these moments as opportunities to engage with individuals who have need of something that only Jesus can change the game about. We're in this series that we're calling Game Changer. And we've been talking about things or moments or scenarios or possibilities in our lives that, man, that would really be a game changer if this could happen or if that could happen. If we could switch the circumstances in this detail, man, it'd be a game changer. It'd change our situation. It'd change our scenario. It would change our season of life if we could have this or that changed. And as we're walking through Matthew chapter 9, we see Jesus changing the game of people's lives as he is encountering them. Jesus is the game changer in people's lives, regardless of what it is that they are dealing with. And how we see Jesus respond to these two people in our text today with these two problems not only is going to change their game, I believe it's going to change our game 2,000 years later. So let's read about these encounters and the game changer that Jesus is as he engages these individuals beyond their inconveniences. Let's pick it up in verse 18. It says, while he, Jesus, was saying these things to them, behold, a ruler came in and knelt before Jesus, saying, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her, and she will live. And Jesus rose and followed him with his disciples. Verse 20. And behold, a woman who had suffered from a discharge of blood for 12 years came up behind Jesus and touched the fringe of his garment. For she said to herself, if I only touch his garment, I will be made well. And Jesus turned and seeing her, he said, take heart, daughter. Your faith has made you well. And instantly, the woman was made well. And when Jesus came to the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making a commotion, he said, go away, for the girl's not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in. And he took her by the hand, and the girl arose. And the report of this went through all that district. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, it's important to know who the primary audience is that Matthew is writing his gospel for. His primary audience is a Jewish audience. And so what just happened with Jesus, man, if you're a Jew in the first century and you're reading this, you're going, whoa, Shazam, twice, wow, doubly unclean. He just touched a dead body and had a woman with a bleeding issue. Double whammy right there, Jesus. Doubly unclean. And what just happened in a matter of moments would have been incredibly inconvenient for Jesus according to Jewish law. Because now what's Jesus going to have to do? He's going to have to call a timeout. He's going to have to go get a shower. He's going to have to wash all of his clothes. He's going to have to go sit in timeout for a while until all of these laws can be fulfilled. Then he can get back in the game. I mean, Jesus was becoming extremely popular because of all the miracles that he was doing and the way that he was teaching with such authority and the way that he was performing miracles and the way that he was feeding people. I mean, his ministry momentum was building like crazy. And now he comes into contact with this woman who has a bleeding issue, and he's about to come into contact with a dead girl. Man, that's about to cause everything to grind to a halt. It's like trying to get out of town on the Friday of Labor Day weekend at 5 o'clock and you're in a hurry. Well, unless you got a helicopter, you're stuck. And Jesus should have been stuck, except that he wasn't. Because Jesus, he doesn't see these people as inconveniences, but as individuals that he is engaging with. And it starts off as Jesus is finishing up a conversation with some people who had asked him a question about fasting and why he and his disciples did what they did. And as Jesus is talking with them at this party over at Matthew, the tax collector's house that he was hanging out with, then he's helping them to see life through a different lens, then all of a sudden it picks up in verse 18. It says, while he's saying these things to them, behold, a ruler came in and knelt before him saying, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she'll live. Now, the gospel writers, Mark and Luke, also record this same story in their Gospels. And they tell us that this ruler who just came in and knelt down before Jesus and made that request, his name actually was Jairus. Would you say Jairus with me? Jairus. So we got Jesus, the game changer, and Jairus, who needs his game changed because his daughter is dead. Just died. The most prominent ruler in all of Jesus's hometown of Capernaum in Galilee, where his ministry is based out of, that guy in that synagogue, his little girl just died. Jairus was one of the elders who was responsible for leading the people, for maintaining order. He would have known who Jesus was. He would have been very aware that there was some tension that was starting to rise amongst the religious people as they're eyeballing Jesus and seeing what he's doing and hearing what he's saying, because religious people typically like to be able to control things, and they can't control this guy. And so there's a tension that's building. His popularity was rising, and Jairus, the synagogue ruler, man, he would have had a lot of clout. He would have had a lot of patches on his varsity letter jacket of all of his accomplishments. He had so much dignity, so much clout, so much weight behind who he was. And yet we see him running in and kneeling down and begging Jesus, do something. I mean, his daughter, who one of the other gospel writers lets us know, she was a 12-year-old girl. Dead. Jesus, you got to do something. Our game just changed. It's over. Unless you come and do something, you got to change the game. I mean, I've got a 12-year-old daughter. And 12-year-old daughters in biblical days are seen as walking into the first year of womanhood. And I see that in my own daughter, walking into womanhood. But a daddy's still a daddy. And Jairus' little girl needed help now. Right now. I mean, when I read this story, the dad in me rises up and remembers when Lucy was not 12, but she was 2, and we were out at our pool in our neighborhood with some friends, and we were out there swimming, and we were out there getting ready to have some lunch, and so we stopped swimming, and now we're doing the little picnic lunch, and the friends, and you know, we've got Jack and Lou are 18 months apart, 19 months apart, and so, you know, our life's kind of crazy, as yours probably is crazy, and you know, we're there, and we're getting lunch fixed, and I mean, there's lots of supervision, and we turn around, and then we turn back around, and all the kids are there, but Lucy's not there. And the daddy in me, the radar in me, just whoa. And I mean, I leapt over the table and the chairs, and I ran to the edge of the pool, and she's sitting on the bottom of it looking up at me like this, going, I need help. And I mean, I jumped down in there, got her up and out, turned her over, breathing again. And everything's right with the world. But I'm telling you, when your little girl is in that kind of a situation, a good daddy moves into action immediately. Now, a good daddy knows when to rescue, and a good daddy also knows when to let his little girl figure things out on her own. Because the last thing that my daughter needs is to grow up thinking that she's dependent on a man for everything. I heard my mentor say that in a message I was listening to last week, and I went, ooh, that's good. That's for me. That's for me. See, sometimes we need to discern, men and women, when we need to rescue our little girl or our little boy, and when they need to sit in the circumstances that they have created for themselves. It's not right always to rescue them when it's in your ability to do so. Sometimes good parenting is knowing when to restrain and watch them get burned. Because until they get burned, they're going to keep putting their hand on the stove. And you know it's going to hurt because you, if you're honest, probably got burned when you were their age. And thank goodness that your mama or your daddy or your guardian let you get burned, not get killed. Get burned. Sometimes what you need to do to have a holy fear of water is to ingest a big gulp of it where you can't breathe. I'm not advocating drowning your kids, okay? Please hear me. But I'm saying sometimes we need a healthy dose of fear. And we need not rescue them always. Doesn't mean we don't love them. It just means sometimes that's how God's going to choose to teach them. And it's my responsibility and it's Allison's responsibility to discern when to rescue and when to retreat and let things play out. That'll ramp your prayer life up a little bit too. But Jairus is not going, well, let's just kind of let this play out a little bit. No. His little girl needs rescuing now, immediately. And if it's going to happen, if the game's going to change, Jesus is the only one who possibly can do it. And so he comes in and just throws dignity to the side and just lays out before Jesus and goes, please come help. My daughter's died. Come lay your hand on her so she'll be well again. And Jesus, you think Jesus knew the purity laws, yes or no? Yes. See, what Jesus could have said is, Jairus, but that dead body thing is kind of a problem. You see, Jairus, I feel for you. I kind of got a lot going on here. I mean, we're at Matthew. Like, I'm a guest of honor at the party here. I can't, like, leave my own party. So, I can't really kind of go ahead right now with you and lay my healing hand on her, because then I couldn't come back to the party, because if I touch your dead daughter, that breaks the no-no law. And then I'd be sidelined, and then I just got all this hygiene stuff. And so, bless you. No, that's not what Jesus says at all. Not at all. Look again in verse 19 at what the game changer does. And Jesus rose and followed him with his disciples. Men and women, Jesus constantly is taking his disciples with him so that he can teach them and disciple them. When we talk about making disciples, you can't do that in isolation. You got to do that by bringing other people along. So how are you doing that, mom and dad? How are you doing that, boss? Are you training people up, or just because of expediency, you can do it faster on your own? Jesus is constantly teaching, constantly bringing his disciples. And in this moment, Jesus can see the fear in Jairus' face, and he hears the trembling in his voice. And what Jesus could have done is just said the word, little girl, get up. You're okay. Now, I hadn't touched you, and I'm still at the party. But he didn't do that, did he? No. Because Jesus is looking beyond this inconvenience into the individual's life who is before him. And he sees Jairus and his daughter need more than a word of blessing. They need physical presence in this moment. And so Jesus gets up from the dinner table at Matthew's house, and off they go. Verse 20, and behold, a woman who had suffered from a discharge of blood for 12 years came up behind Jesus and touched the fringe of his garment, his robe. For she said to herself, if I only touch his garment, I'll be made well. And Jesus turned and seeing her, he said, take heart, daughter, your faith has made you well. And instantly the woman was made well. Great. Now Jesus is unclean because this bleeding woman has touched his garment. Do you notice how long she'd been dealing with this chronic bleeding issue? Anybody catch that? How many years? How old is Jairus' daughter? For as long as Jairus' daughter has been born and living, this woman has been dealing with a chronic illness that has left her marginalized in her society. That's like starting in first grade with no friends at the lunch table, and now you're a senior and you're still sitting by yourself. And it's been like that every single day of your school career. That's how long she's been ostracized. So Jesus is on his way to deal with and heal this daughter of a man who's in the upper class of society, which means the daughter is too because of who her daddy is. And on the way, Jesus encounters a woman who's so desperate for healing that she'll do anything to get well. If I just touch the fringe of his garment, just the tassel on his robe, I'll be made well. The other gospel writers, Luke especially, who was a doctor, who's kind of dialed into medical stuff, said that this woman had gone from doctor to doctor, spending all she had trying to find relief, and she still couldn't find relief, Norma. She still couldn't find it. She's at her wits' end. She's not any better, and she's on the verge of becoming bitter. And she reaches out, and she touches Jesus' garment. And he wheels around, and what'd he call her? Daughter. Not dirty old woman. Not inconvenient truth, but daughter. Lovely and precious one who is valuable to God. And he tells her, your faith has made you well. Underline that phrase, made you well. Made you well. In the Greek, that word translates saved you or rescued you. Out of the bottom of the pool, breathing air again. I made Lucy well. If I just touch the fringe of his garment, it's not a hocus pocus thing. It's a faith that if I get close enough and can touch, he'll save me. He'll make me well. He'll rescue me. Jesus turns, your faith has made you well. You didn't earn it. You didn't buy it. You didn't say the right religious prayer or give enough money. You just received it. Your faith in me, woman, daughter, is what saved you. You know what that moment can be categorized as? A game-changing moment. That's a game changer right there. That's a game changer. This whole game-changing story is about faith in Jesus that saves us. And this woman pushed all her chips in to Jesus to save her, and he did it. He changed her game. And Jairus has pushed all of his chips in on Jesus to save his daughter. And Jesus now is on his way to change her game and move her from being a perishing pawn upstairs to being raised to life because the king has just come into contact with her. See, while the law says that now Jesus and all the other people with whom this bleeding woman has come into contact with, now they all need to go take a time out and go home and bathe and wash their clothes and isolate themselves for a bit. The law says it's time to leave. I know that this is really inconvenient, but it's the law, and Jesus' love trumps the law and says, I'll lean into the inconvenience. Let's go. And his love for Jairus and his love for Jairus' 12-year-old little girl compels him to go to his house. Verse 23, and when Jesus came to the ruler's house and saw the flute players, that's kind of weird, and the crowd making a commotion, he said, go away, for the girl is not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him. Underline that. And they laughed at him. They laughed at him. Literally, in the Greek language, it translates, they laughed Jesus down. Have you ever had somebody laugh at you so hurtfully that with every ha, 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 it's like they're just smashing you into the ground? If you've ever felt like that, you're in good company because Jesus just got laughed down. And if you've felt that way, cheer up. The king is with you and he's for you. He's with you and he's for you. They mocked Jesus. They ridiculed Jesus. So what's up with these flute players? In Jewish times, in Jesus' day, when somebody died, they would hire flute players to come and kind of disrupt the rhythm. And they would hire people to come and wail and cry and mourn. I've done a lot of funerals. I've never been to one where when I walked in, that's never happened. When I walk into a funeral, usually it's, hi, how you doing? Oh, yeah. I know. Yeah, bless you. So good. Yeah, doing okay? Okay. Yeah, I know. He was such a good person. It's quiet. It's respectful. We finish up, and sometimes we go and have snacks and chips at somebody's house. But here, oh man, the flute player, the flautist is just flouting. People are mourning and wailing because they're paid to be there to do it. And the family then would come out and just like, anybody used to watch WWE or WWF back when Hulk Hogan was there? Larry, yeah. Larry, let me talk to you for a second because you're my people. The Hulkster would come out and he would just rip open the Hulkamania and everybody would go crazy. That's what you do. You'd rip open right here to show your heart's breaking. You got a flute player, you got hired people to be sad for you, and you come out and rip your shirt up. Jesus comes to the house, tells the funeral crowd, she's not dead but sleeping. They start laughing Jesus down. He clears the house in verse 25. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl arose. And the report of this went through all the district. So according to Jewish law, Jesus is now doubly unclean. Did you catch that? Because he's touched or been touched by two different kinds of people from the no-no list. One is dead and the other one was what? She was bleeding. A woman was bleeding and both have touched her. And Jesus looks past the inconvenience of both to these individuals.
And the other gospel accounts of this story said that Jesus went inside Jairus's house with Jairus, with Peter, James, and John. He comes over to the daughter, and he not only grabs her by the hand, but he speaks to her, Talithukumi, which means, little girl, get up. And she did. And then the story goes viral. And everybody around Galilee knows about this before the sun sets. Why? Because Jesus is a game changer. He changed the woman who was bleeding for 12 years and had been labeled unclean. Then he brings a 12-year-old little girl back from the dead because her daddy advocated for her in a humbling and in a moving manner. And I know what you're thinking. Wow, that's nice. So what? That's a fair question. So what? Well, what became clear to me and convicting to me as I'm praying and asking Jesus, what's the so what from this passage? I mean, it's amazing that you changed the game of these two people's lives 2,000 years ago in the middle of some really inconvenient circumstances. Because you see the individual beyond the inconvenience. So what do you want us to do with this? So what is this going to matter for the people of Arapahoe Road? How is this supposed to apply as the game changer in our lives? And what became really clear to me is that if we're going to be the people who consistently are being conformed into the image of Jesus, I prayed that during my prayer this morning. Romans 8:29, Paul says, "For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed into the image of Jesus." That is God's goal for your life, to look like, act like, respond like, and become like Jesus. Not to become Jesus, but to become just like Jesus. And if we are to become like Jesus, be conformed to his image, then what if all the inconveniences are what God uses to make us like Jesus? What if all, can we put that on the screen? What if all the inconveniences, right there, are what God uses to make us like Jesus? Why don't you take a snapshot of that, a screenshot of that? And let that be before you this week. What if all the inconveniences are what God's going to use to make me like his son Jesus? I mean, what if it's the inconveniences that become the game changer in you and the game changer in me, as well as for the individual that we may have the opportunity to help, to bless, to serve? What if this week you started to say yes more than you said no to those inconvenient encounters? And just by saying that, what comes to my mind are what all of my mentors who are great leaders and all the leadership stuff that I ever took told me, if you're the leader, you can't say yes to everything. You got to say no to most things so you can know what to say yes to. Anybody else take that course? You took it, you bet. 5 years old and already taking leadership courses. That's awesome. What are they doing at Lionheart? I tell you what, that's awesome. You got to say no to 99% of the things that cross your path so that you know what to say yes to, so that it can maximize your time and you not be sidelined by trivial things. Because, I mean, you can't help everyone, right? I mean, that's not a trick question. There's 8 billion people on the planet. You can't help everyone, right? And did you go to class that, well, if you don't bring a cupcake for everyone, you can't bring a cupcake for anyone, because that's not, it's not fair. Well, I agree. But then I get convicted when I look at Jesus' life. And what if you and I began to do what I heard a man named Manly Stanley say one time, and he said, do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. Just do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. I mean, it may be inconvenient, but don't miss the individual. And God may want to use those inconveniences that cross our path to be the game changers in us to make us more like Jesus. What if you committed to do for one what you wish you could do for everyone? See, it's the inconveniences. Those are what God is going to use to make us just like Jesus. I mean, think about it. What if all of heaven erupts with unexplainable joy every time an inconvenience comes your way and you don't look past it, but you lean into it and then you see the individual as well? And they're just like, whoa, he did it. He did it. What if you leaned into an inconvenient moment this week and all of heaven, because of your obedience, when the Holy Spirit nudged you to slow down, all of heaven got to laugh down hell. Ha, ha, ha. She did it. She did it. How's that feel, hell? This is who she's becoming. You thought you could sidetrack her. You thought she was an untouchable. She's had her game changed. He's still changing her game. And it's destroying hell one inconvenient moment at a time. That's heaven on earth kind of stuff. And Jesus said, when you've done it to the least of these, to the biggest inconvenience, you've done it to him. So when your frustrating coworker asks you for the 1,000th time for help, and you're like, oh my goodness, how many times do I have to do this? Lean in to the inconvenience and see the individual. Students, when your parents ask you again for help with technology because you know what you're doing, what if you looked at them not as a problem to be solved so they'll go away, but as people that you get to serve? What if you helped that person who was in your way that you know needed help, and you just, instead of blowing past them, stopped and you helped that one? Can't help everyone, but what if you did for one what you wish you could do for everyone? And we began to lean into the inconvenience and see the individual that the Lord is inviting you to see and bless in his name. If we do, we will be experiencing the game changer in our lives in some of the most unique ways that you can possibly imagine.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Feel free to distribute this recording, but please do not sell or alter it in any way. For more information about Arapahoe Road Baptist Church, please visit our website at arapahoeroad.org. Arapahoe Road Baptist Church is located at 2256 Arapahoe Road in Garland, Texas, with Sunday morning worship service at 10:45 a.m. We hope you'll join us this week.